Chapter 1. A Parade in Erinrung. From the Archives of Hein, Transcript of Ansible, Document 01-01101-934-2, Gethen. To the Stabil on Olul. Report from Genli I. First Mobile on Gethen. Winter. Heinisch Cycle 9-3. Ecumenical Year 1490. To 97. I'll make my report as if I told a story, for I was taught as a child on my home world that truth is a matter of the imagination. The soundest fact may fail or prevail in the style of its telling, like that singular organic jewel of our seas, which grows brighter as one woman wears it and worn by another dulls and goes to dust. Facts are no more solid, coherent, round, and real than pearls are, but both are sensitive. The story is not all mine, nor told by me alone. Indeed, I am not sure whose story it is. You can judge better. But it is all one, and if at moments the facts seem to alter with an altered voice, why then you can choose the fact you like best. Yet none of them are false, and it is all one story. It starts on the 44th diurnal of the year 1491, which on the planet Winter, in the nation Karhide, was Ardhahahad Tua, or the 22nd day of the third month of spring in the year 1. It is always the year 1 here. Only the dating of every past and future year changes each New Year's day as one counts backwards or forwards from the unitary now. So it was spring of the year 1 in Erinrung, capital city of Karhide, and I was in peril of my life and did not know it. I was in a parade. I walked just behind the Gossowers and just before the king. It was raining. Rain clouds over dark towers, rain falling in deep streets, a dark, storm-beaten city of stone, through which one vein of gold winds slowly. First come merchants, potentates, and artisans of the city Erinrung, rank after rank, magnificently clothed, advancing through the rain as comfortably as fish through the sea. Their faces are keen and calm. They do not march in step. This is a parade with no soldiers, not even imitation soldiers. Next come the lords and mayors and representatives. One person, or 5, or 45, or 400, from each domain and co-domain of Karhide, a vast ornate procession that moves to the music of metal horns and hollow blocks of bone and wood and the dry, pure lilting of electric flutes. The various banners of the great domains tangle in a rain-beaten confusion of color, with the yellow pennants that bedeck the way, and the various musics of each group clash and interweave in many rhythms, echoing in the deep stone street. Next, a troop of jugglers with polished spheres of gold, which they hurl up high in flashing flights, and catch and hurl again, making fountain jets of bright jugglery. All at once, as if they had literally caught the light, the gold spheres blaze bright as glass. The sun is breaking through. Next, 40 men in yellow playing Gossowers. The Gossower, played only in the king's presence, produces a preposterous, disconsolate bellow. 40 of them, played together, shake one's reason, shake the towers of Erinrung, shake down a last spatter of rain from the windy clouds. If this is the royal music, no wonder the kings of Karhide are all mad. Next, the royal party, guards and functionaries and dignitaries of the city, and the court, deputies, senators, chancellors, ambassadors, lords of the kingdom, none of them keeping step or rank, yet walking with great dignity. And among them is King Argovan, 15, in white tunic and shirt and breeches, with leggings of saffron leather and a peaked yellow cap. A gold finger ring is his only adornment and sign of office. Behind this group, 8 sturdy fellows bear the royal litter, rough with yellow sapphires, in which no king has ridden for centuries, a ceremonial relic of the very long ago. By the litter walk 8 guards, armed with foray guns, also relics of a more barbaric past, but not empty ones, being loaded with pellets of soft iron. Death walks behind the king. Behind Death come the students of the artisan schools, the colleges, the trades, and the king's hearths. Long lines of children and young people in white and red and gold and green. And finally, a number of soft-running, slow, dark cars end the parade. The royal party, myself among them, gather on a platform of new timbers beside the unfinished arch of the river gate. The occasion of the parade is the completion of that arch, which completes the new road and river port of Erinrong, a great operation of dredging and building and road-making which has taken 5 years and will distinguish Argovan XV's reign in the annals of Carhide. We are all squeezed rather tight on the platform in our damp and massive finery. The rain is gone. The sun shines on us, the splendid, radiant, traitorous sun of winter. I remark to the person on my left, "It's hot. It's really hot." The person on my left, a stocky dark carhider with sleek and heavy hair, wearing a heavy overtunic of green leather worked with gold, and a heavy white shirt and heavy breeches, and a neck chain of heavy silver links a hand broad, this person, sweating heavily, replies, "So it is." All about us, as we stand jammed on our platform, lie the faces of the people of the city, upturned like a shoal of brown, round pebbles, mica glittering with thousands of watching eyes. Now the king ascends a gangplank of raw timbers that leads from the platform up to the top of the arch, whose unjoined piers tower over crown and wharves and rivers. As he mounts, the crowd stirs and speaks in a vast murmur. "Argovan." He makes no response. They expect none. Gossowers blow a thunderous, discordant blast. Peace. Silence. The sun shines on city, river, crowd, and king. Masons below have set an electric winch going, and as the king mounts higher, the keystone of the arch goes up past him in its sling, is raised, settled, and fitted almost soundlessly, great ton-weight block though it is, into the gap between the two piers, making them one thing, an arch. A mason with trowel and bucket awaits the king up on the scaffolding. All the other workmen descend by rope ladders like a swarm of fleas. The king and the mason kneel high between the river and the sun on their bit of planking. Taking the trowel, the king begins to mortar the long joints of the keystone. He does not dab at it and give the trowel back to the mason, but sets to work methodically. The cement he uses is a pinkish color, different from the rest of the mortar work, and after 5 or 10 minutes of watching the king bee work, I ask the person on my left, "Are your keystones always set in a red cement?" For the same color is plain around the keystone of each arch of the old bridge that soars beautifully over the river upstream from the arch. Wiping sweat from his dark forehead, the man, I must say, having said he and his, the man answers, "Very long ago, a keystone was always set in with a mortar of ground bones mixed with blood. Human bones. Human blood. Without the blood bond, the arch would fall, you see. We use the blood of animals these days." So he often speaks, frank yet cautious, ironic, as if always aware that I see and judge as an alien. A singular awareness in one of so isolate a race and so high a rank. He is one of the most powerful men in the country. I am not sure of the proper historical equivalent of his position, vizier or prime minister or counselor. The Karhidish word for it means the king's ear. He is lord of a domain and lord of the kingdom, a mover of great events. His name is Therum, Harth, Rem, or Estravan. The king seems to be finished with his masonry work, and I rejoice. But crossing under the rise of the arch on his spider web of planks, he starts in on the other side of the keystone, which after all has two sides. It doesn't do to be impatient in Carhide. They are anything but a phlegmatic people, yet they are obdurate, they are pertinacious, they finish plastering joints. The crowds on the Cess embankment are content to watch the king work. But I am bored and hot. I have never before been hot on winter. I never will be again, yet I fail to appreciate the event. I am dressed for the ice age and not for the sunshine, in layers and layers of clothing, woven plant fiber, artificial fiber, fur, leather, a massive armor against the cold, within which I now wilt like a radish leaf. For distraction, I look at the crowds and the other paraders drawn up around the platform, their domain and clan banners hanging still and bright in sunlight. And idly, I ask Estravan what this banner is and that one and the other. He knows each one I ask about, though there are hundreds, some from remote domains, hearths and triblets of the pairing storm border and Kermland. I'm from Kermland myself, he says, when I admire his knowledge. Anyhow, it's my business to know the domains. They are Carhide. To govern this land is to govern its lords. Not that it's ever been done. Do you know the saying, Carhide is not a nation, but a family quarrel? I haven't, and I suspect that Estravan made it up. It has his stamp. At this point, another member of the Karomi, the upper chamber or parliament which Estravan heads, pushes and squeezes a way up close to him and begins talking to him. This is the king's cousin, Permer Hargerem Irtibi. His voice is very low as he speaks to Estravan, his posture faintly insolent, his smile frequent. Estravan, sweating like ice in the sun, stays slick and cold as ice, answering Tibby's murmurs aloud in a tone whose commonplace politeness makes the other look rather a fool. I listen as I watch the king grouting away, but understand nothing except the animosity between Tibby and Estravan. It's nothing to do with me in any case, and I am simply interested in the behavior of these people who rule a nation in the old-fashioned sense, who govern the fortunes of 20 million other people. Power has become so subtle and complex a thing in the ways taken by the Ecumen that only a subtle mind can watch it work. Here it is still limited, still visible. In Estravan, for instance, one feels the man's power as an augmentation of his character. He cannot make an empty gesture or say a word that is not listened to. He knows it, and the knowledge gives him more reality than most people own. A solidness of being, a substantiality, a human grandeur. Nothing succeeds like success. I don't trust Estravan, whose motives are forever obscure. I don't like him, yet I feel and respond to his authority as surely as I do to the warmth of the sun. Even as I think this, the world sun dims between clouds regathering, and soon a flaw of rain runs sparse and hard upriver, spattering the crowds on the embankment, darkening the sky. As the king comes down the gangplank, the light breaks through a last time, and his white figure and the great arch stand out a moment, vivid and splendid, against the storm-darkened south. The clouds close. A cold wind comes, tearing up Port and Palace Street. The river goes gray. The trees on the embankment shudder. The parade is over. Half an hour later, it is snowing. As the king's car drove off up Porton Palace Street and the crowds began to move like a rocky shingle rolled by a slow tide, Estravan turned to me again and said, "Will you have supper with me tonight, Mr. I?" I accepted with more surprise than pleasure. Estravan had done a great deal for me in the last 6 or 8 months, but I did not expect or desire such a show of personal favor as an invitation to his house. Hargerem Irtibi was still close to us, overhearing, and I felt that he was meant to overhear. Annoyed by this sense of effeminate intrigue, I got off the platform and lost myself in the mob, crouching and slouching somewhat to do so. I'm not much taller than the Gathenian norm, But the difference is most noticeable in a crowd. That's him. Look, there's the envoy. Of course, that was part of my job, but it was a part that got harder, not easier, as time went on. More and more often, I longed for anonymity, for sameness. I craved to be like everybody else. A couple of blocks up Brewery Street, I turned off toward my lodgings, and suddenly, there where the crowd thinned out, found Tibby walking beside me. "A flawless event," said the king's cousin, smiling at me. His long, clean yellow teeth appeared and disappeared in a yellow face all webbed, though he was not an old man, with fine, soft wrinkles. "A good augury for the success of the new port," I said. "Yes, indeed." More teeth. "The ceremony of the keystone is most impressive." "Yes, indeed. That ceremony descends to us from very long ago. But no doubt Lord Estravan explained all that to you." "Lord Estravan is most obliging." I was trying to speak insipidly, yet everything I said to Tibby seemed to take on a double meaning. "Oh, very much indeed," said Tibby. "Indeed, Lord Estravan is famous for his kindness to foreigners." He smiled again, and every tooth seemed to have a meaning, double, multiple, 32 different meanings. "Few foreigners are so foreign as I, Lord Tibby. I am very grateful for kindnesses." "Yes, indeed, yes, indeed. And gratitude's a noble, rare emotion, much praised by the poets. Rare above all here in Erinrong, no doubt, because it's impracticable. This is a hard age we live in, an ungrateful age. Things aren't as they were in our grandparents' day, are they?" "I scarcely know, sir, but I've heard the same lament on other worlds." Tibby stared at me for some while as if establishing lunacy. Then he brought out the long yellow teeth. "Ah, yes, yes, indeed. I keep forgetting that you come from another planet. But, of course, that's not a matter you ever forget. Though no doubt life would be much sounder and simpler and safer for you here in Erinrong if you could forget it, eh?" "Yes, indeed. Here's my car. I had it wait here out of the way. I'd like to offer to drive you to your island, but must forego the privilege, as I'm due at the king's house very shortly. And poor relations must be in good time, as the saying is, eh?" "Yes, indeed," said the king's cousin, climbing into his little black electric car, teeth bared across his shoulder at me, eyes veiled by a net of wrinkles. I walked on home to my island. Carhash Island, the usual word for the apartment boarding house buildings that house the greatest part of the urban populations of Carhide. Island contained 20 to 200 private rooms. Meals are communal. Some are run as hotels, others as cooperative communes. Others combine these types. They are certainly an urban adaptation of the fundamental Carhidish institution of the hearth, though lacking, of course, the topical and genealogical stability of the hearth. Its front garden was revealed now that the last of the winter snow had melted, and the winter doors, 10 feet above ground, were sealed off for a few months, till the autumn and the deep snow should return. Around at the side of the building, in the mud and the ice, and the quick, soft, rank spring growth of the garden, a young couple stood talking. Their right hands were clasped. They were in the first phase of Kimmer. The large, soft snow danced about them as they stood barefoot in the icy mud, hands clasped, eyes all for each other. Spring on winter. I had dinner at my island, and at fourth hour, striking on the gongs of Remy Tower, I was at the palace, ready for supper. Carhiders eat 4 solid meals a day, breakfast, lunch, dinner, supper, along with a lot of adventitious nibbling and gobbling in between. There are no large meat animals on winter, and no mammalian products, milk, butter, or cheese. The only high-protein, high-carbohydrate foods are the various kinds of eggs, fish, nuts, and the Hainish grains. A low-grade diet for a bitter climate, and one must refuel often. I had got used to eating, as it seemed, every few minutes. It wasn't until later in that year that I discovered the Gathenians have perfected the technique not only of perpetually stuffing, but also of indefinitely starving. The snow still fell, a mild spring blizzard, much pleasanter than the relentless rain of the thaw just past. I made my way to and through the palace in the quiet and pale darkness of snowfall, losing my way only once. The palace of Erenrang is an inner city, a walled wilderness of palaces, towers, gardens, courtyards, cloisters, roofed bridgeways, roofless tunnel walks, small forests and dungeon keeps, the products of centuries of paranoia on a grand scale. Over it all rise the grim, red, elaborate walls of the royal house, which, though in perpetual use, is inhabited by no one beside the king himself. Everyone else, servants, staff, lords, ministers, parliamentarians, guards, or whatever, sleeps in another palace, or fort, or keep, or barracks, or house, inside the walls. Estervan's house, sign of the king's high favor, was the corner red dwelling built 440 years ago for Harmes, beloved Kemmering of Emron III, whose beauty is still celebrated, and who was abducted, mutilated, and rendered imbecile by hirelings of the Innerland faction. Emron III died 40 years after, still wreaking vengeance on his unhappy country. Emron the ill-fated. The tragedy is so old that its horror has leached away, and only a certain air of faithlessness and melancholy clings to the stones and shadows of the house. The garden was small and walled. Serum trees leaned over a rocky pool. In dim shafts of light from the windows of the house, I saw snowflakes and the thread-like white spore cases of the trees falling softly together onto the dark water. Estervan stood waiting for me, bareheaded and coatless in the cold, watching that small, secret, ceaseless descent of snow and seeds in the night. He greeted me quietly and brought me into the house. There were no other guests. I wondered at this, but we went to table at once, and one does not talk business while eating. Besides, my wonder was diverted to the meal, which was superb. Even the eternal bread apples, transmuted by a cook whose art I heartily praised. After supper, by the fire, we drank hot beer. On a world where a common table implement is a little device with which you crack the ice that has formed on your drink between drafts, hot beer is a thing you come to appreciate. Estervan had conversed amiably at table. Now, sitting across the hearth from me, he was quiet. Though I had been nearly 2 years on Winter, I was still far from being able to see the people of the planet through their own eyes. I tried to, but my efforts took the form of self-consciously seeing a Gathenian first as a man, then as a woman, forcing him into those categories so irrelevant to his nature and so essential to my own. Thus, as I sipped my smoking sour beer, I thought that, at table, Estravan's performance had been womanly, all charm and tact and lack of substance, specious and adroit. Was it, in fact, perhaps this soft, supple femininity that I disliked and distrusted in him? For it was impossible to think of him as a woman, that dark, ironic, powerful presence near me in the firelit darkness. And yet, whenever I thought of him as a man, I felt a sense of falseness, of imposture. In him, or in my own attitude towards him, his voice was soft and rather resonant, but not deep. Scarcely a man's voice, but scarcely a woman's voice either. But what was it saying? "I'm sorry," he was saying, "that I've had to forestall for so long this pleasure of having you in my house. And to that extent, at least, I'm glad there's no longer any question of patronage between us." I puzzled at this a while. He had certainly been my patron in court until now. Did he mean that the audience he had arranged for me with the king tomorrow had raised me to an equality with himself? "I don't think I follow you," I said. At that he was silent, evidently also puzzled. "Well, you understand," he said at last, "being here, you understand that I am no longer acting on your behalf with the king, of course." He spoke as if ashamed of me, not of himself. Clearly there was a significance in his invitation and my acceptance of it, which I had missed. But my blunder was in manners, his in morals. All I thought at first was that I had been right all along not to trust Estervan. He was not merely adroit and not merely powerful. He was faithless. All these months in Erenrang, it had been he who listened to me, who answered my questions, sent physicians and engineers to verify the alienness of my physique and my ship, introduced me to people I needed to know, and gradually elevated me from my first year's status as a highly imaginative monster to my present recognition as the mysterious envoy about to be received by the king. Now, having got me up on that dangerous eminence, he suddenly and coolly announced he was withdrawing his support. "You've led me to rely on you." It was ill done. "Do you mean that having arranged this audience, you haven't spoken in favor of my mission to the king as you..." I had the sense to stop short of promised. "I can't." I was very angry, but I met neither anger nor apology in him. "Will you tell me why?" I was very angry, but I met neither anger nor apology in him. "Will you tell me why?" After a while, he said, "Yes," and then paused again. During the pause, I began to think that an inept and undefended alien should not demand reasons from the Prime Minister of a kingdom, above all when he does not, and perhaps never will, understand the foundations of power and the workings of government in that kingdom. No doubt this was all a matter of Shifkathor, prestige, face, place, the pride relationship, the untranslatable and all-important principle of social authority in Karhide and all civilizations of Gethen. And if it was, I would not understand it. "Did you hear what the king said to me at the ceremony today?" "No." Estravan leaned forward across the hearth, lifted the beer jug out of the hot ashes, and refilled my tankard. He said nothing more, so I amplified, "The king didn't speak to you in my hearing." "Nor in mine," said he. I saw at last that I was missing another signal. Damning his effeminate deviousness, I said, "Are you trying to tell me, Lord Estravan, that you're out of favor with the king?" I think he was angry then, but he said nothing that showed it. Only, "I'm not trying to tell you anything, Mr. I." "My God, I wish you would." He looked at me curiously. "Well then, put it this way. There are some persons in court who are, in your phrase, in favor with the king, but who do not favor your presence or your mission here. And so you're hurrying to join them, selling me out to save your skin," I thought. But there's no point in saying it. Estravan was a courtier, a politician, and I a fool to have trusted him. Even in a bisexual society, the politician is very often something less than an integral man. His inviting me to dinner showed that he thought I would accept his betrayal as easily as he committed it. Clearly, face-saving was more important than honesty. So I brought myself to say, "I'm sorry that your kindness to me has made trouble for you." Coals of fire. I enjoyed a flitting sense of moral superiority, but not for long. He was too incalculable. He sat back so that the firelight lay ruddy on his knees, and his fine, strong, small hands, and the silver tankard he held, but left his face in shadow. A dark face, always shadowed by the thick, low-growing hair and heavy brows and lashes, and by a somber blandness of expression. Can one read a cat's face, a seal's, an otter's? Some Gethenians, I thought, are like such animals, with deep, bright eyes that do not change expression when you speak. "I've made trouble for myself," he answered, "by an act that had nothing to do with you, Mr. I. You know that Karhide and Orgrin have a dispute concerning a stretch of our border in the High North Fall, near Safanoth. Argovan's grandfather claimed the Sinith Valley for Karhide, and the Commensals have never recognized the claim. A lot of snow out of one cloud, and it grows thicker. I've been helping some Karhidish farmers who live in the valley to move back east across the old border, thinking the argument might settle itself if the valley were simply left to the Orgata, who have lived there for several thousand years. I was in the administration of the North Fall some years ago and got to know some of those farmers. I dislike the thought of their being killed in forays or sent to voluntary farms in Orgrin. Why not obviate the subject of dispute? But that's not a patriotic idea. In fact, it's a cowardly one, and impugns the Shifkathor of the king himself." His ironies and these ins and outs of a border dispute with Orgrin were of no interest to me. I returned to the matter that lay between us. Trust him or not, I might still get some use out of him. "I'm sorry," I said, "but it seems a pity that this question of a few farmers may be allowed to spoil the chances of my mission with the king. There's more at stake than a few miles of national boundary." "Yes, much more. But perhaps the Ecumen, which is 100 light-years from border to border, will be patient with us a while." "The Stabiles of the Ecumens are very patient men, sir. They'll wait 100 years or 500 for Karhide and the rest of Gethin to deliberate and consider whether or not to join the rest of mankind. I speak merely out of personal hope and personal disappointment. I own that I thought that with your support..."
"I too. Well, the glaciers didn't freeze overnight." Cliché came ready to his lips, but his mind was elsewhere. He brooded. I imagined him moving me around with the other pawns in his power game. "You came to my country," he said at last, "at a strange time. Things are changing. We are taking a new turning. No, not so much that, as following too far on the way we've been going. I thought that your presence, your mission, might prevent our going wrong, give us a new option entirely. But at the right moment, in the right place. It is all exceedingly chancy, Mr. I." Impatient with his generalities, I said, "You imply that this isn't the right moment. Would you advise me to cancel my audience?" My gaffe was even worse in Karhidish, but Estevan did not smile or wince. "I'm afraid only the king has that privilege," he said mildly. "Oh, God, yes, I didn't mean that. I put my head in my hands a moment. Brought up in the wide-open, freewheeling society of Earth, I would never master the protocol or the impassivity so valued by Karhiders. I know what a king was. Earth's own history is full of them. But I had no experiential feel for privilege, no tact. I picked up my tankard and drank a hot and violent draught. Well, I'll say less to the king than I intended to say when I could count on you."
"Good."
"Why good?" I demanded.
"Well, Mr. I, you're not insane. I'm not insane. But then neither of us is a king, you see. I suppose that you intended to tell Argovan, rationally, that your mission here is to attempt to bring about an alliance between Gethin and the Ecumen. And rationally, he knows that already, because, as you know, I told him. I urged your case with him, tried to interest him in you. It was ill done, ill-timed. I forgot, being too interested myself, that he's a king, and does not see things rationally, but as a king. All I've told him means to him simply that his power is threatened. His kingdom is a dust mote in space. His kingship is a joke to men who rule 100 worlds. But the Ecumen doesn't rule, it coordinates. Its power is precisely the power of its member states and worlds. In alliance with the Ecumen, Karhide will become infinitely less threatened and more important than it's ever been." Estevan did not answer for a while. He sat gazing at the fire, whose flames winked, reflected from his tankard and from the broad, bright silver chain of office over his shoulders. The old house was silent around us. There had been a servant to attend our meal, but Karhiders, having no institutions of slavery or personal bondage, hire services, not people, and the servants had all gone off to their own homes by now. Such a man as Estevan must have guards about him somewhere, for assassination is a lively institution in Karhide, but I had seen no guard, heard none. We were alone. I was alone with a stranger inside the walls of a dark palace, in a strange, snow-changed city, in the heart of the ice age of an alien world. Everything I had said, tonight and ever since I came to Winter, suddenly appeared to me as both stupid and incredible. How could I expect this man or any other to believe my tales about other worlds, other races, a vague, benevolent government somewhere off in outer space? It was all nonsense. I had appeared in Karhide in a queer kind of ship, and I differed physically from Gethinians in some respects. That wanted explaining. But my own explanations were preposterous. I did not, in that moment, believe them myself.
I believe you, said the stranger, the alien alone with me. And so strong had my access of self-alienation been that I looked up at him bewildered. I'm afraid that Argovan also believes you, but he does not trust you, in part because he no longer trusts me. I have made mistakes, been careless. I cannot ask for your trust any longer, either, having put you in jeopardy. I forgot what a king is. Forgot that the king in his own eyes is Carhide. Forgot what patriotism is, and that he is, of necessity, the perfect patriot. Let me ask you this, Mr. I. Do you know by your own experience what patriotism is? No, I said, shaken by the force of that intense personality suddenly turning itself wholly upon me. I don't think I do. If by patriotism you don't mean the love of one's homeland, for that I do know. No, I don't mean love when I say patriotism. I mean fear, the fear of the other, and its expressions are political, not poetical. Hate, rivalry, aggression. It grows in us, that fear. It grows in us year by year. We followed our road too far. And you, who come from a world that outgrew nations centuries ago, who hardly know what I'm talking about, who show us the new road... He broke off. After a while, he went on, in control again, cool and polite. It's because of fear that I refuse to urge your cause with the king now, but not fear for myself, Mr. I. I'm not acting patriotically. There are, after all, other nations on Geffen. I had no idea what he was driving at, but was sure that he did not mean what he seemed to mean. Of all the dark, obstructive, enigmatic souls I had met in this bleak city, his was the darkest. I would not play his labyrinthine game. I made no reply. After a while, he went on rather cautiously. If I've understood you, your ecumen is devoted essentially to the general interest of mankind. Now, for instance, the Argota have experience in subordinating local interests to a general interest, while Carhide has almost none. And the commensals of Orgrin are mostly sane men, if unintelligent, while the king of Carhide is not only insane, but rather stupid. It was clear that Estravan had no loyalties at all. I said in faint disgust, it must be difficult to serve him if that's the case. I'm not sure I've ever served the king, said the king's prime minister, or ever intended to. I'm not anyone's servant. A man must cast his own shadow. The gongs in Remney Tower were striking sixth hour, midnight, and I took them as my excuse to go. As I was putting on my coat in the hallway, he said, I've lost my chance for the present, for I suppose you'll be leaving Erenrong. Why did he suppose so? But I trust a day will come when I can ask you questions again. There's so much I want to know. About your mind speech, in particular. You'd scarcely begun to try to explain it to me. His curiosity seemed perfectly genuine. He had the effrontery of the powerful. His promises to help me had seemed genuine, too. I said yes, of course, whenever he liked, and that was the evening's end. He showed me out through the garden, where snow lay thin in the light of Gethin's big, dull, rufous moon. I shivered as we went out, for it was well below freezing, and he said with polite surprise, You're cold? To him, of course, it was a mild spring night. I was tired and downcast. I said, I've been cold ever since I came to this world. What do you call it, this world, in your language? Gethin. You gave it no name of your own? Yes, the first investigators did. They called it Winter. We had stopped in the gateway of the walled garden. Outside, the palace grounds and roofs loomed in a dark, snowy jumble, lit here and there at various heights by the faint gold slits of windows. Standing under the narrow arch, I glanced up, wondering if that keystone, too, was mortared with bone and blood. Estravan took leave of me and turned away. He was never fulsome in his greetings and farewells. I went off through the silent courts and alleys of the palace, my boots crunching on the thin, moonlit snow, and homeward through the deep streets of the city. I was cold, unconfident,
obsessed by perfidy and solitude and fear.